I think that Trump in the near term, well, Trump overall for the next 4 years will be extremely good for the U.S. oil and gas industry, both in terms of forward-thinking legislation, but he also is going to subsidize the industry in the sense that he's going to keep the interest rate artificially low. A low cost of capital in a capital-intensive business is a very, very, very good thing. And with one eye on the U.S. trade balance, he will discontinue the Biden policy of slow-tracking liquefied natural gas on the U.S. eastern seaboard to ship into European markets. There's been a de facto attempt to reduce oil and gas transmission, processing, and liquefaction for the last 4 years. And that party's coming to a screeching halt, which will benefit domestic oil stocks. I think the domestic mining industry will benefit too, for unfortunate reasons. Yes, I think that the regulatory regime around mining will loosen up to some degree.
Good afternoon or good morning to you, Rick. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. The better, of course, for being in discussion with you.
So something happened about a little over a week ago, and I want to talk about that. I want to get your 30,000 foot, give that to me, and feel free to talk.
Oh, I guess you have a third of the country that's elated, and a third of the country that's despondent, and a third of the country that didn't really care much. So I think you start with that. I'm disturbed at the level of discourse between those who loved it and those who hated it. I think that as a people, we need to agree to disagree civilly. Maybe I believe that because I'm 71 as opposed to 21. Maybe my feelings at 21 would have been different than my feelings at 71. But that's the top line feeling. The second is from the point of view of the issues that I'm interested in, not much is going to change. The issues that matter to me are individual liberty, being protected from the government, not being protected by the government, and arithmetic. And neither party seemed to be offering very much to me in terms of protection from them. Rather, their selling point was by them. And with regards to arithmetic, I guess arithmetic, a facility with arithmetic makes somebody unelectable. Let me go deeper into the last point. The on-balance sheet liabilities of the U.S. government, as of last week, now exceed $36 trillion. For reference, that's over 120% of gross domestic product. If you want to feel a little better about that number, the Fed's own balance sheet, which is to say their holdings of treasury bonds, is about $7 billion, or $7 trillion, I'm sorry. I just lost three zeros. Which means that the net on balance sheet liabilities of the U.S. government are only $29 trillion. That's a problem. It's a greater problem in that rather than servicing that debt because of the deficit, we increase that number by $2 or $2.5 trillion a year. To put that in reference, almost half of the federal government spending is comprised of deficit spending, which is to say we're spending money that we aren't taking in. Rather, we're adding to the debt. And if that doesn't make your listeners unhappy enough, I'll make them really unhappy next. The off-balance sheet liabilities of the U.S. government, the promises that we have paid to we've made to each other, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, federal pensions, military pensions, the Environmental Trust Fund, according to our government, exceed $100 trillion. That's not the nominal value over 30 years. That's the net present value of unfunded liabilities. That's what we owe in promises in excess of what we've set aside to honor those promises. So if you add the on-balance sheet liabilities to the off-balance sheet liabilities, as a society, we owe $130 trillion. Now let's put that number in reference. The Internal Revenue Service, maybe not a great source, but the only source I have, suggests that their estimate of the net private wealth of Americans is $140 trillion. So collectively, we're worth $140 trillion, and we owe $130 trillion. That's not a very good outcome from my viewpoint. The Republican platform would seem to be to defend some of their constituencies from some of the more aggressive aspects of tax, while simultaneously finding other victims to extract revenue from. Because the Republicans don't propose necessarily anything specific about saving money. Now, Andy, Republicans will rise up in furor at that last statement and say that Trump is going to impanel Elon Musk and another group of experts. Elon, by the way, is an expert at extracting subsidies from the U.S. government. I'll grant you that he's an expert. And that this panel of experts is going to cut government expenditures by 80%. That's horseshit. All anybody who doubts me has to do is read a book called The Triumph of Politics by David Stockman, who chronicles the first 180 days of the Reagan Revolution, and how the Reagan Revolution got sidetracked by reality, which is to say, politics. The Democrats make no pretense. The Democrats' answer to the problem is tax the billionaires. Let's do the math on taxing the billionaires. The on-balance sheet liabilities of the federal government grow by $2.5 trillion a year. The off-balance sheet liabilities of the federal government grow, depending on who is giving you the estimate, between $2 and $4 trillion a year. Let's take the mid number. Three. Add $2.5 trillion on-balance sheet accretion and $3 trillion off-balance sheet accretion, and the net deficit of the U.S. government is about $5.5 trillion. The Internal Revenue Service suggests that the aggregate net wealth of all the billionaires in the United States is $5.6 trillion. If rather than increasing their taxes, you simply stole all their money, you would eliminate the deficit, not government spending. You would eliminate the deficit for 1 year, which is to say the Democrats don't propose to deal with the arithmetic. They're dealing with the narrative, just like the Republicans. So from a headline point of view, the election solved no problems for me. I'm interested in being protected from my government, not by my government. People who voted to be protected by their government from other aspects of their society. And both sides propose to ignore arithmetic. A couple of quotes before we move on, Andy. You're going to be sorry that you asked me this question by the end of my answer. The great American journalist, admittedly an anti-Semite, H.L. Mencken, suggested that you could understand politics by understanding that elections were advanced auctions of stolen goods. politicians promise to shield you from the depredations of others while stealing on your behalf. Interest groups, lobbies, special interests are always the high bid in elections.
Yeah.
We need to understand that, irrespective of party. Probably a better description, though, came from Gore Vidal, who said that you understand the political process by understanding the root words in politics. Poly, of course, from the Greek for many. But tick, from the English colloquial for small blood-sucking insect. If you think of the process as a bunch of small blood-sucking insects, each trying to suck the lifeblood out of the other, while shielding themselves from the depredations of other ticks, I think you understand politics. From a practical, less lofty viewpoint, let's look at some things. My suspicion is that financial markets, at least for the time being, will like a Trump presidency. He has promised more vociferously than the Democrats to lower interest rates. Lower interest rates benefit people with access to credit and people with the knowledge to use it. Lower interest rates penalize savers on behalf of spenders and investors. Financial markets are just that sort of person. It is unlikely, too, that Mr. Trump will change the tax status that Wall Street enjoys with regards to the treatment of carried interest as capital gains. Although carried interests are capital gains, the Democrats have proposed to treat them as employment income or ordinary income. Changing the tax treatment on the carried interest from the capital gains rate to the ordinary income tax rate, something that Wall Street wouldn't like at all, and something that I suspect Mr. Trump will shelter them from. Similarly, I think the domestic oil and gas industry, and to a lesser extent, the domestic mining industry, will benefit. I think that Mr. Trump will be more vociferously in favor of onshore drilling, including fracking, that he will be more aggressive opening up federal lands, including frontier lands and offshore lands, to drilling. And I think that he'll be much more friendly with regards to the expansion of energy-related infrastructure, including pipelines and liquefied natural gas facilities. So on balance, for natural resource investors, a Trump presidency is probably a good thing. Unfortunately, Trump has this idea that America isn't part of the world, that we're an island apart. And Mr. Trump has suggested that you replace taxes with tariffs. Two problems with that. The first is that tariffs are a tax. They're spelled differently, but they're the same thing. The second is that he's convinced some morons that foreigners are going to pay. That isn't what happens. The purchaser of the product is going to pay. It's just that you pay from your left pocket as opposed to your right pocket. But a much bigger problem is that it simplifies the global supply chain worldwide. The truth is that we are all reliant on each other as customers, as suppliers, in every way, shape, or form. And that plan, an America First plan, that doesn't understand that to be first, America must be most competitive, is a plan that's absolutely doomed to fail. And people who rely on it will rely on it to their detriment. To the extent that Mr. Trump, I think, tries to implement this plan, what he will find is that he will disenfranchise more of our trading partners than predecessor governments have. That's a very high test. We've weaponized the U.S. dollar. We've stolen foreign assets denominated in U.S. treasuries. The idea that Mr. Trump proposes to make a bad situation worse is unfortunate. I am hopeful that Mr. Trump will negotiate from a very hard place with regards to immigration. I believe in immigration. My own great-grandfather was an illegal immigrant. He came to the United States from Italy. his entry papers, he didn't have any papers from Italy, his entry papers were marked WOP, without papers, which is how Italians came to be recognized as WOPs. I am all for immigration, but I'm for legal immigration. I'm for the rule of law. My suspicion is that Mr. Trump will fight this very, very, very hard. And my hope is that the ultimate outcome is that people who arrive in this country without legal status will be denied social services. Draconian, to be sure. Dramatic, to be sure. But the idea that a family, and I talked to a family of this type 3 weeks ago, who is waiting for family reunification legally with their family members in the queue, while other people stream across the southern border, particularly where those people have access to the social services that reduce their incentive to work, is not a good thing.
Right.
And my hope is that if Mr. Trump is able to make any real contribution, it'll have to do with the implementation of the rule of law with regards to immigration. I think that Mr. Trump is eager to do a tax cut. And I think that rich people look forward to that. By the way, the suggestion that tax cuts benefit the rich is true because they pay the tax. 50% of Americans don't pay any tax. So how is a tax cut going to benefit them? The top 1% of U.S. taxpayers pay 40% of the income and capital gains tax. So obviously, if you have a tax cut, the benefit's going to accrue to the upper income taxpayers. 10% of the taxpayers pay 90% of the tax. And so of course a tax cut's going to benefit the rich because those are the only people who pay tax.
Right.
This is truly silly. Other forms of tax, that's different. You know, sales taxes, excise taxes, stuff like that. But for income and capital gains tax, only rich people pay. The problem is, Andy, that a tax cut without a spending cut is fraud.
Yep.
The tax delayed.
Mm-hmm.
It is easy to give people benefit, but it's not easy to impose a cost. In order for a tax cut to be anything other than a fraud, you have to have a spending cut. Otherwise, it's a tax that you aren't paying, but your children and your grandchildren are. Remember the arithmetic again. $130 trillion in obligations with a private net worth of $140 trillion. A tax cut without a spending cut is fraud. Reagan suggested, well, we'll do the tax cut first. We'll do the spending cut later. Probably not a deliberate lie. Read The Triumph of Politics, a functional lie. I hope that's enough about the election for the time being. I think we've probably engendered enough hate of your podcast in the, 20 minutes that have elapsed?
Well, I have a few questions and maybe some few. Well, I'd like to have a conversation more about it, if it's okay with you.
Ladies,
I didn't expect this either, because I thought, okay, Rick and I are going to talk what we like and what we love. We'll talk about what this means for natural resources, which we did. But I want to delve into this a little bit more. My wife is a legal immigrant. You met her. She is from Eastern Europe. We met, not to get into too far my family history, but 27 years ago. And I and my family, not just because of her, but I'm very pro-immigration myself. Immigrants are the hardest working people I've ever met. My being one of them. She's living the air quotes, the American dream. Developed her own private practice here, got a PhD. On and on and on. That all being said, she also, we are very well aware of our school systems and our kids are not in government schools, but it's being completely overrun. The educational system here in Atlanta, where I'm talking to you from, by illegal immigration. Also, the crime is skyrocketed by illegal immigration. And also, not to say immigrants are completely still a crime, but when you have such chaos coming into your country, it's almost like what's to expect. And it's completely bankrupting, as you pointed out, social services. And I think that's part of the big backlash with all of this, the immigrants that I've just said. Your thoughts on that?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. Certainly in many cities in the United States, there would seem to be the reputation of the rule of law. In San Francisco, as an example, if you steal less than $1,000 worth of merchandise, you won't be charged.
That worked out well, but not sure.
I'm a believer in the rule of law. If the problem with regards to the implementation of the rule of law, if police departments have been overtly anti-Black, as an example, let's deal with that. I remember in my youth, as a consequence of the vicious overreach of the Oakland Police Department, a little community self-policing organization came about called the Black Panther Party. They just decided that what they would do is trail police cars in their cars, well-armed. I'm not opposed to that, but I believe in the rule of law. The whole concept of illegal immigrant is interesting, too. Andy, I'm not running for president, by the way, but I could cut crime by half myself because I'd make less stuff illegal. Prior to 1964, we had a program in the United States called the Bracero Program, and we permitted 600,000 Mexicans in those days to come across our border legally with an orange card and work the harvest for 6 months and go home. They didn't want to bring up their kids in the United States. They were part of a famine migration. They would come up, work here for 6 months, make enough money that they could sustain their families and their villages back home. And they weren't illegal because they were legal.
Right.
Political pressure was applied on the government by the Mexican-American population that didn't want competition in the farms. And Bobby Kennedy, his brother's, if I have it right, attorney general, turned 600,000 legal workers into illegal workers. I personally would prefer a circumstance where people were permitted to come work in the United States for a fixed period of time, in fixed circumstances, and go home. That makes absolute sense to me. I grew up myself in rural California in an agricultural circumstance. I worked alongside those people in the summer. This is before OSHA, when they'd let an 8 or 9 year old work, you know, and they were great people. I mean, they were fantastic people. They were not criminals.
Right.
Safest place in the whole world for me was working in that orchard alongside those families. Had somebody proposed to do me harm, there wouldn't have been enough of them left to bury.
Right.
These were not criminals. They were great people. And our country was built on immigrants,
yeah,
including, of course, the Native Americans, who were immigrants too. You know, but I think that the American immigration system should be reformed in America's interest. I think that we should prioritize immigrants who are young, educated, skilled, and particularly skilled in skill sets that Americans need. There is a belief system in the United States that's extremely generous, that immigration should be based on the need of the immigrant. And I happen to disagree with that. I think immigration should be based on the need of the nation.
Yeah.
Should there be compassionate exemptions? Sure. I mean, should we maybe, as an example, have been more generous admitting Vietnamese refugees who were displaced partially as the consequence of a war we started? I have a sense of humor for that. Should we be more generous in the current circumstance, perhaps, with Ukrainians or Russians who are fleeing conscription in Russia? Probably. But most of U.S. immigration should emphasize people who are going to make a positive contribution to the material well-being of American society.
Yeah. Well said. It reminds me everything that you just talked about, and I'm going to drop a name, and it's not to get political party, but somebody and greatly admire Ron Paul's basically said, well, first thing you do is just take away the incentives,
right?
And make it, and give incentives for the hard workers to bring more. That would be my immigration. Let's see. So that's fair enough.
Well, there was a point in time before he ran for president that I knew him very well personally. Spent a lot of time with him, had lunches with him, had dinners with him, hung out with him. First of all, this guy's not racist.
No.
He's not anti-immigrant. If I recall correctly, his congressional district was Uvalde in Texas, which is an agricultural district. So he had plenty of experience as an OBGYN okay. with Hispanic communities. This guy's a top quality human being. And I don't think that there's anything that you and I are saying about the rule of law or immigration that Ron wouldn't agree with. You will note that he was singularly unsuccessful as a Republican candidate for president, which suggests that while you and I like him, he is persona non grata with the Republican establishment and, frankly, with most of the Republican constituency, which is unfortunate.
It was unfortunate. Also very telling. So you talked about, if we can go back to tax policy with tariffs, and I want to make sure I got this right. I wrote this down. It's going to simplify, putting on tariffs would simplify the global supply chain.
No, complicate the global supply
chain. Complicate, pardon me.
The exact opposite. Our supply chains are interconnected.
Got it. I was going to call you out. I was like, how's that simplified?
I mean, you look at places where the U.S. is really, really, really super efficient on a global basis. Oil field equipment, as an example. The supply chain around oil field equipment comes from everywhere. It's not like all the components that go into a drill rig that's fabricated in Midland are manufactured in Midland. They're assembled in Midland, but they come from everywhere. And I'm just using that as an example. The global supply chains, really beginning in the 1980s, have become truly, truly, truly global. We're really, really, really interconnected. Yes, all the stuff that we buy in Walmart, almost all that crap, toys, clothes, stuff like that, comes from China.
Right.
But all the stuff we export, Caterpillar tractors, computers, even software. We collaborate, as an example, with the Indian intellectual capital foundries, groups of engineers in India who solve some of the mundane technical challenges that we don't want to solve or can't afford to solve for ourselves. These supply chains are completely interconnected, and we need to understand that the material well-being of humankind benefits from specialization. There are some people in some places, some companies in some places, some societies, who are simply better at some things than other people. And the idea that we impose artificial barriers on superior performance makes everybody poorer. It makes us poorer, too. What Trump is really saying to Americans is, you aren't good enough to compete. So I'm going to protect you
right.
from people who are better than you.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm an old, fat, bald 71-year-old. I want to be protected from him, not by him. There's 7 or 8 young kids in India who can employ technology to screen value stocks or mining stocks or oil stocks better than me. Let's have a fight.
Let's go. Yeah. It's funny you bring up, it made me think of you bringing up India and the technology. I guess the technology picture, I live in Atlanta, and Georgia Tech is literally 3 miles down the road from me. 4 miles down the road. My son is a huge Georgia Tech fan. You go on the Georgia Tech campus and it's like part of it, you're like walking in Little India. They are, and it's awesome. They settle here and now we have all of their intellectual, as a country, we have, and our companies have all of the intellectual capital.
You know, the idea that we take these really smart kids into this country, we give them the best education in the world, still, for all our faults.
Yeah.
Then we make them go home.
Yeah.
That's insane.
It's exciting. It's utterly insane.
You look at the Taiwan semiconductor industry, the best in the world. All American trained.
Right.
And we sent them home. I'm not trying to say that we should impose slavery, that we should make them stay. But we sure ought to try and keep them. The idea that we give them a wonderful Stanford or MIC or Caltech education and then make them go home is the height of insanity.
Yeah, that's insanity. Let's go back and we'll end on this a little bit more to a natural resource portfolio. And I'm thinking, and I don't know how the software or bad this interview is going to go with discussions, and I really don't care, but most of our listeners, that's what I think they're most concerned about. You talked about oil and gas being easier, well, across the board, not easier, but being good for oil and gas, the drilling and the mining. I want to get to oil and gas specifically. Do you see that as an impact on the oil and gas price or bullish on the equities? Because
bullish on the equities. I mean, maybe in the near term, a Trump presidency keeps the price of oil and gas low. It has been really U.S. production that's been the swing production. We have doubled our production in the United States as a consequence of our wonderful capital markets and our wonderful technology. And I think that continues under Trump. Longer term, unless technology improves radically, I think that you're going to see a cresting in U.S. production, irrespective of internal policy, just because given the current technology, we're running out of grade A drilling locations. We've done such a wonderful job that we're depleting our inventory.
Right.
I think oil prices go up without some new disruptive technology, because I think the influx of American crude and American natural gas crests, and the oil industry as a whole, including in the United States, is underinvesting in sustaining capital by about $1 billion a day. And I think 2 years out, 3 years out, 4 years out, that chronic underinvestment comes back to bite the world in terms of oil supplies. I think that Trump in the near term, Trump overall for the next 4 years will be extremely good for the U.S. oil and gas industry, both in terms of forward-thinking legislation, but he also is going to subsidize the industry in the sense that he's going to keep the interest rate artificially low. A low cost of capital in a capital-intensive business is a very, very, very good thing. And with one eye on the U.S. trade balance, he will discontinue the Biden policy of slow-tracking liquefied natural gas on the U.S. eastern seaboard to ship into European markets. There's been a de facto attempt to reduce oil and gas transmission, processing, and liquefaction for the last 4 years. And that party's coming to a screeching halt, which will benefit domestic oil stocks. I think that domestic mining industry will benefit too, for unfortunate reasons. Yes, I think that the regulatory regime around mining will loosen up to some degree. Unfortunately, the Biden administration has chosen to begin to subsidize the mining industry. In other words, to steal from regular taxpayers to benefit people in the mining business. And I think that theft, that transfer of wealth, despite the fact that they're transferring it to me, will continue. and will accelerate. And I think it's a very bad thing. I think if a mine isn't a mine without subsidy, it isn't a mine. But the supply chain pundits, the national security pundits, feel very differently. And I think the truth is that the preference of a cranky old libertarian in Washington state isn't one that they're particularly concerned about. So I think that a Trump administration will benefit the uranium industry. I think it'll benefit the nuclear power industry. I think if we ever have a rare earths or specialty materials industry in the United States, it'll benefit that too. I'm not so sure if a Trump administration will be able to directly benefit the mining industry in terms of permitting, which is often a state and local issue. It may be, if Mr. Trump ends up being popular, I think that's a very open question, that political leadership arguing in favor of increased investment in U.S. minerals production will assist the industry in permitting drives. Mm-hmm. I note, Andy, that in a pretty good mining state, Arizona, the leading copper-producing state in the United States, with wonderful infrastructure, I mean, just mind-boggling infrastructure, there is a copper deposit called Resolution, which has over a billion tons of ore grading 1.5%. For reference, three times the average mine grade worldwide. It's in a great location. It's next door to a copper mine. It has highways. It has rail. It has water. It has power. It has adjacent communities that have copper miners living in it. It has a regulatory atmosphere at the state level where they are experienced with copper mining because it's what they've done for 100 years. That deposit has been stuck in permitting for 26 years. I'm not sure that the federal government has enough nexus in that discussion that a Trump presidency would have any impact on local permitting. To the extent that you operate in a jurisdiction like Texas, Wyoming, Nevada, or Alaska, where the local politics and the state politics are already favorable to mining, I think that the overlay of federal acquiescence will be very important. As an example, there's a wonderful copper deposit in northern Alaska, controlled by a Canadian company called Trilogy. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. It's not actually just a deposit, it's a group of deposits. The state is in favor of it. The Native Corporation is in favor of it. But the Biden administration would not allow the company to build an access road across federal land to reach the deposit. So the deposit was sterilized. Despite community support and state support, the federal government didn't attack the permitting for the deposit directly because they had no nexus. What they did is they eliminated any probability that the mine could get built. I think the Trump administration will reverse that decision within 6 months.
I lied. I want to end on this. I interviewed Mark Faber, Dr. Mark Faber. It's been about 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago. And he is of the opinion that a Trump presidency, and he's not like yourself and myself, he's pretty agnostic. But he sees it as highly inflationary. What is your opinion on that? Because of the spending that's coming in and that we already have, I think.
I don't think there's a difference between Trump and Biden with regards to that, or Harris. I liken them to Tweedledum and Tweedledummer, and I think they're interchangeable. You get elected by promising people things.
Yeah.
And the truth is, if you're a politician, it's not fun to be the guy who denies hospital funding or highway funding or things like that. I think Dr. Faber is absolutely correct that Trump will do what's fun. If you look at his personal history, it's not like the guy's been adverse to spending money. And it's not like that the guy has been a stranger to bankruptcy. And I think Dr. Faber, in that regard, is, by the way, as in many regards, is absolutely correct.
All right. Well, Rick, if people want to do business with you, how do they do that? They already know, but I want to make sure you have a shout out here.
By the way, I welcome Democrats and Republicans to do business with me. I'm not being deliberately antagonistic to anybody. If you care what I have to say about natural resources and like the way you think, I'll personalize it for you. Go to my website, ruralinvestmentmedia.com, and list your natural resource stocks. I will personally, for free, no obligation, rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. And I'll comment on individual issues if I think my comments have any value. Please, no crypto. Please, no tech stocks. Please, no pot stocks. Natural resource stocks only. And separate and apart from that, as you can see by my shirt, I'm celebrating retirement by starting a new bank called Battle Bank. If you're unhappy with your existing bank for any reason, say they don't pay you interest on your checking or savings account, and you think that your savings deserve interest, check out Battle Bank. If you think that your IRA should be your IRA, if you think that your IRA should be able to own a duplex or a triplex or buy a franchise or invest in private equity, with Battle Bank, your IRA will be just that, your IRA. It won't be a repository for mutual funds or annuities from Wall Street. If you think that's a good idea, check out Battle Bank. Finally, if you're among the millions of Americans who jointly control $33 billion worth of gold or silver, physical gold and silver in segregated accounts, and you don't have access to credit, check out Battle Bank. For some reason, no other bank in the United States seems to think that gold or silver are good collateral. I do. If you're a gold or silver holder in physical safe storage, segregated storage, by all means, check out Battle Bank. Battlebank.com, or go to Rural Investment Media, list your natural resource stocks, and in the question and comment section, just write bank. If you're unhappy with your bank, check out our bank.
Excellent. Put all of this in the show notes in both the YouTube video as well as the podcast. Rick, it's always a pleasure. I love chatting with you.
Thank you, Andy. I apologize for my rant, but I feel very strongly about the issues that you introduced us to.
My pleasure. Take care.
Thank you.